Hello, this is Justin from TED Learning. Welcome to the next in our series of podcasts on lived experiences. Today we talk about being Black in Britain and Black History Month. I'm delighted to be joined by Danny Mosley and Leon Wander, both actors, both Black and both born in the UK. In today's podcast, we talk about their individual lived experiences and the importance of Black History Month. Danny and Leon, welcome.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
So why is Black History Month so important to both of you?
Well, we had this conversation about how important it is to us. Now, we're very much of the ilk of it should just run throughout the whole year. So that word being important, I get why it needs to be in schools, even though in schools it's in October and October has a half term, so it's only 3 weeks. And actually schools only really deal with it for 1 week intensely. And then the other weeks they just have stuff around the schools saying, hey, Martin Luther King and slavery, eh?
Martin Luther King, Malcolm X or Harriet Tubman.
Yeah.
And
maybe getting Nelson Mandela in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just slavery will be the main focus, as it always has been in school. Like when it comes to Blackness or anything to do with Black, it's just slavery. It just starts at slavery. I remember one time I was in school, it's quite young, and my brain just can, I was like, but where do Black people come from? Like my, I just couldn't figure it out. I was like, but you just keep telling us slaves, but what, was there something before slavery? At one point I actually thought we just like magically appeared in a cotton field. But where do we come from? And there is no emphasis on that at all. It's just literally, you were slaves, enslaved, but you, as one is called, you were slaves and Britain freed you. And that's it. And the importance of Black history is to celebrate the contributions of Black people to the world. And like Dennis said, it shouldn't just be a month. It should just be all inclusive, because Black history is all history in terms of that. It's just learning world history. Yeah, absolutely. And it should be that. So it's important for young Black people to see that, and also older generations to see their contributions and see times gone by as well, but also what's happening now. So it's extremely important, but it's also sad that it's only relegated to a month.
Yeah.
A month that is a half term during that. In America, it's February, the shortest month of the year. So it started off as just being a week initially in America, and they rallied and they changed it to it being a 4 month. But of course, stipulation was, let's make it in February, and over here, let's make it in October, which tends to be half term month. So it's important, but it's just a shame that it is just that minute thing, because it's extremely imperative for everybody to know.
And it's vast, like considering how much Black history there is. Like, again, there's the same things that get churned out, but how many schools talk about how many Black inventors there were? How many schools talk about Egyptian times and before those times? How many schools talk about the Windrush generation that's happening, things that are happening right now? So I just, and even Black history in terms of how music's changing, the different types of things that music and instruments are, like, I just think it's very, this is what it was in America. There's, again, there's not a lot of British
history.
Yeah, Black history. Yeah. And there's loads of people to talk about in that, but doesn't get talked about. So it's important when it's done right, but it's not always done right.
Absolutely.
Like there were Black Tudors.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's a,
we just don't talk about it. We just talk about the six wives.
Yeah.
Henry VIII.
Yeah, it literally, like, there's only focal points of history, and it's like there's so much more of a richer history there. Like Danny said, the Black Tudors. I didn't know that till I was in my mid-30s, in terms of that, this idea that Black people just came over on Windrush, that, again, that's all you ever taught, the mass migration was just Windrush. It's like Black people have been here from the 15th century and they've been documented here, which, again, hidden in plain sight, because you go to the museums and you'll see the pictures of it, there are books of it, in terms of there are ledgers with Black people being here in the UK, Scotland, like a vast diaspora within the UK, and it's just not talked about. It's just they were brought here as enslaved, and it's like actually they were here long before the transatlantic slave trade ever actually happened. So that's incredibly important. It also gives Black people who are here a sense of belonging as well, which is very much stripped away from you in terms of that. So yeah, I would like to see it throughout the whole.
And also, like, learning about Roman history, there's Septimius Severus, which was an African Roman emperor.
Yeah.
Why don't we know that? Why is the first massive black person we know is either Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and then maybe Barack Obama?
Yeah, but absolutely.
When we learn about Roman empires, why are we not talking about Septimius Severus? It's just things like that. Yeah. Just like, so what, like, even you told me today,
Ira Aldridge.
Ira Aldridge, who's a black actor in Shakespeare.
The first black actor for Shakespeare, the first black actor to play white and black characters within Shakespeare. He was seen as one of the best actors of his day.
And we're actors. Why don't we know about that?
Why don't we know that history as well? Even down to the Greeks, this constant thing of the Greeks done everything. It's like, well, no, the Greeks in their own diary, if you go to the British Museum, if you read and like really research, and you have to dig on these things, most of the Greeks will tell you in their own diary, like all those main, the poets and the literates, like all of them will tell in their own diary, they went to Egypt to study for 20 years before they became that thing. And they took what they learned and brought it back. But we always have this thing of everything started in Greece. And that's actually, no, it's not true. They went to what we now call Africa. And they learned there and they studied there under these people who had seen the stars. They mapped out everything. When the Europeans thought the world was flat, everybody over there knew the world was round. They knew the stars are constellations. The pyramids are built within the circumference of the earth. Mm-hmm. But then the story is that you met savages and people who didn't know they needed your help to evolve as people. And it's like, you were still chucking poo-poo out of toilet windows at the time when you came across these people because you didn't have, the rich had toilet systems, but the poor did not have latrine systems at that time. So it's extremely important and it should just be enfolded with everybody's history all mingling into one because as a human race, it is just one thing. But it's a vast history, but we only get taught these moments and times that benefit just a certain group of people.
A narrative.
Which is irritating.
Yeah. So growing up in the UK, when were you aware of your racial identity?
I was aware. When was the first time? The first time I was aware was when I remember that I went to a play scheme in the summer. I think I was about 8. And there was these two white boys and I was friends with this other white girl. Don't know her name. And we kind of they liked us. And then they were like, oh, we're going to go off and tell you who we like. So we were like, okay. And we were like, oh, what do you think? And I was like, I think they're going to like you more. And she said, no, I think they're going to like you more. And anyway, they came back and they were like, oh, yeah, we like both of you, but we like, let's just say her name was Lucy. We're like, oh, but we like Lucy more because, you know. And I knew, you like Lucy more because she's white and because I'm black, which was interesting because he had a little younger brother who was cute little blonde boy, blue eyes, really sweet. And he was like, well, I like her better. She's great. Talking about me. And it was the first time I was just like, there's nothing I can do about the fact that I look like how I look and that's why you like me. And even that's like a, you know, boys like me or whatever. I don't even know if I really like them at that point. But it was just a case of that's a signifier that you're outed. And then I had another experience when I was 9 where we were playing hide and seek at a school party with someone. And these two boys, everyone like hid, but they found me. And then kind of like punched me and pushed me over sort of thing. And then went back and then was playing with everyone else like it never happened. And I remember telling my mom at the time, she's like, oh no, I'm sure it's fine. But then having that conversation with my mom when I was a teenager and I think they kind of did it because I was black and she's like, probably. But back then, you know, what are you gonna do, what are you gonna say? So I was just like, interesting.
Mine was primary as well. There was an incident that happened between myself, a girl and another boy that was there. Kids were literally in primary, I think was, how old was it? I don't even remember how old we were, but we weren't in like year 6, it could have been year 5 or year 4. And I'd hit the girl on the bum. Both me and the boy had hit the girl on the bum, but she'd hit us. And kids being kids, but we'd hit her and then she started crying, cool. But then I was suspended from primary, for hitting her, but the other boy who was white wasn't suspended. I couldn't understand why I was being suspended for it. We all hit each other. And it wasn't until I was listening to my mum on the phone to one of her friends saying, it's racist why they've suspended him. And I, at this point, I'm in primary school, I don't understand anything about race or that I'm different per se in that way. And my mum saying, it's because I'm black, why I was suspended. I remember my mum being furious and going up to the school, but I just remember distinctly that conversation she was having, her saying it's racist and it's because he was black why he was suspended. And that was the first time for me where I was like, huh. Okay. So this thing that's never been an issue between my friends and I, now there is a difference because I am the skin colour for my friends and I, it's just, I'm white, you're black. Playtime, let's go and drink our milk, let's go and have fun. But for that was the first time something had been put onto me and my mum had named it and called it, and that stuck with me. But then I forgot about it, and it wasn't until years later my mum reminded me with her terrible memory, I don't know how she remembered, and I was like, oh yeah, I remember that moment. But that was the first time that it was apparent to me that this is somewhat different to everybody else now.
And so that's your earliest memory of experiencing racism.
Yeah.
What's it been like as an adult? What type of things have you experienced as adults where the colour of your skin has meant that people have treated you differently, less favourably?
Loads. And it's not even just my skin, it's my hair.
Uh-huh.
My afro offends people. It's too big. It's too in the way. It's untidy. It's not appropriate. It's not professional.
Uh-huh.
So that's one aspect.
The reason I have shorter hair, my hair used to be quite, I was growing my hair out for a really long time. My hair used to be down to my shoulders, used to get the braids and everything. And I remember my agent at the time said to me, if you have long hair, you'll never be taken seriously because you'll always be the thief. And so that really threw me, because already my brain is thinking all you ever see of black people on the TV, and this is many, many years ago, was these particular roles. You will be the thief, you will be the bad person. And she was like, if your hair's long, you will always just be seen as that. And so I cut my, I cried the first time I cut my hair, because at this point I'd made a conscious decision to be growing out my hair, and I was getting styled and everything, and I was loving my hair. And once, as a black person, there's a moment in hair growth where your hair is just the most irritating thing in the world, because you just don't know what to do with it, how to style it, what to do. And no matter how many times you brush it, it always just goes back to its curls and the nappy curls and just looks like it hasn't been brushed. But once it's out and long and you can do loads of things with it, it's great and it's fantastic. And I was loving my hair. And I remember her saying that to me, and I made a decision to cut my hair because I was like, well, I need to take my acting career seriously. And I didn't, it never even occurred to me that this was a white woman telling me, you will always be looked at as a thief and you'll never be taken seriously if you have long hair. And I made a decision to cut my hair. And I remember crying when I was cutting my hair, because I was like, this has taken me a very long time to grow and to nurture and to take care of it for me so long. But yeah, hair instances are massive things. Mm-hmm. It can be, here in this country, it's always the microaggressions.
Yeah.
It's never
your tone.
Yeah, the tone of voice or the way you're policed in how you speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always, more often than not, it's always these racial undercurrents when those moments are happening. And it makes you sometimes question, like, did that just happen?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, but then you have other people around you who sometimes tend to be white because they don't see it. And even if you say it to someone, it's like, no, I'm sure it wasn't that. And you sometimes question your own self. It's like, am I being too sensitive? Am I just taking on board? Am I having a bad day or something like that? But it's actually no, but your gut instinct was actually correct, what you felt it was.
But can you give me an example of that? Because microaggressions is an expression used quite often. And I know from having watched a lot of content online that that can be used as a justification for bad behaviour, poor behaviour towards somebody else. What sort of things have happened to you that might be brushed off as a microaggression, but actually happening quite regularly can have that really negative impact on you?
I suppose one of them ones is the age-old one when you walk into spaces, particularly shops, and you suddenly get followed around the shops. Like, you're literally just going in there to look at things. I'm coming to buy something. I'm in a supermarket. I'm coming to buy things, and then immediately, it happened just yesterday. Immediately, as you're walking around, the security person, they want you to know that they're there. Or sometimes they like to hide, play hide and seek with you. So I sometimes play hide and seek with them. So I'll walk around to different aisles. I'll wait for them to appear. I've actually gone up to security and been like, if you want to make yourself useful, could you please at least hold my basket as we go around together? Please. Because it's getting, it's beyond just, you're checking out everyone. Yeah. I now know you're following me around the store because I've gone into sections that I don't need to be in. I just wanted to know if you were here, and here you are right on time. And it's like, they just pop their head around. It's like, I can see you. You're in a bright jacket. I can see you following me. So those are just the age old ones, but it happens all the time. Every once, once or twice you can pass it off as just...
Yeah. I mean, even for me, and I've said this before, it's always my tone.
Mm-hmm.
My tone. I've said this before, as a black woman, you're either passive or you're aggressive or you're passive aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
But you're never assertive. So you can never just say something clearly and directly. It's always come with attitude. You know, I get told that it's attitude, and like, oh, if it's a white woman, it's like, oh, aren't they a bit fiery?
Yes.
If it's a black woman, it's all like, oh, well, that's just
being
rude.
Aggressive.
Yeah, and just like really like not acceptable. And it's just like, I'm just talking to you. So now I have to navigate myself, or before I go to say something, I have to stop and think, how is this going to be taken?
Yeah.
And then I always have to talk with an upward inflection, just so that you understand that I'm really not, I have to make my voice higher so I'm not being threatening. So you understand that I just want to say what I want to say.
That must be exhausting.
It's exhausting.
How is something going to land?
Yeah.
Rather than actually, I don't have to think about that. I mean, obviously as human beings, when we're working with different people in different situations, sometimes we have to think, how might what I need to say, if it's difficult, land? Okay. But I don't have to think about it 24/7. Yeah. How you're describing it is you've constantly got to think about, how am I going to be perceived?
Or the smiling thing. The one way you sometimes have to smile at people just so they know you're not a threat to them. Now, yes, there's an element of that that's down to a male, especially if I'm with a female, there's an element of just being male in a space, but it's less being a male in a space. It's more about being a black male in a space, because our skin has been weaponized against us for you to see me as a threat. Your first instinct might be, I'm potentially a threat to you. So there've been lots of times as I've been growing up where I have overly smiled and sit in rooms with white people, just so you know I'm not a threat in any way. I'm here just like you were here. For whatever reason we're here, I'm here for the exact same reason, but I've now got to overly smile or overly play that role, just so you know I'm not problematic in that way.
I've got to know you, and I think the first time I met you, I felt, and it was in a train station because we were heading off to do some work, the warmth that I got from you when I first met you, I've never felt that. But you're not the first black male that's described that, and I know from conversations that we've had that you've described just walking down the street and people crossing the road.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel?
I've had that a lot. And sometimes I do understand in terms of the where we are in terms of the safety for women sometimes. Totally understand that in terms of that. But more often than not, it's been the look of... It's so hard to describe somebody sometimes, because it is just... It's the look that you see in somebody's eye. And they've given me a particular look, probably not even realizing that it's actually happening for them, but I can see it, and it's the look, and it's the grabbing of the purse, holding it close to them. And it's like, girl, your purse doesn't match anything I'm wearing, so don't worry about it. I'm not going to be taking your purse. So on some level, I do understand that in terms of the male-female dynamic, but on the other level, it is they'll fully cross the road, or sometimes I'll give somebody a wide berth because I'm like, I can't even bother for you to even look at me, or if it to become a thing, let me just give you a wide berth.
So
anyway,
preemptive, yeah, well, I'll do that.
And sometimes, and yeah, there's an argument, sometimes I could be looking into it this moment too much, however this is what has always constantly prior been, so
that's your lived experience.
Yeah,
isn't
that's
it, your experience
is
that's how people react just by seeing you, rather than actually getting to know Leon.
And I'm like, I'm 5'6". Like, what am I going to do to you?
Yeah.
I can't even sit on this chair.
Are you 5'6"? That's fine. Because you're in this chair.
Can't even sit on this chair
that.
With my feet dangling. Like, what am I doing to you?
I know. And hugging the cushion for some irrational reason. I think one of the most interesting things is he's alluded to his age, which is a very sensitive subject for you. You said when I was in my mid-30s.
I know. I was like,
Notice how I stopped.
Yeah, I did. I want to just go back to the hair discussion, because you mentioned it, and it's a project that Ted worked on a couple of years ago, which you helped us with for a school. This kind of fascination with black people's hair. Have both of you experienced that with people wanting to come and touch it to this very and stuff?
Yeah.
To this very, to this
people,
very
don't want, people don't want to come and touch it. People just touch it.
Touch it.
So if you don't lean back, they're asking as they're going in for it. Uh-huh. So it's called, it's like this symbiotic dance that we're both doing. Because what are you doing? And I even have friends that do it now. My friend was like, oh my gosh, your hair's so nice. And then she was like,
you see
can
the hands
I?
Coming.
And I was like, I mean, you've asked. So yeah, you can. And then so she touched it and that was it. And this was extension at this point. So she touched it, that was it. And then we're talking about something else. She's like, yeah. And then she just grabbed it again. And I just thought, what is this comfort for you? I don't understand. Yeah. I don't know what the fascination is.
It's insane.
Is. It's weird.
It's so insane. Well, like, I don't get it. It's hair. It's hair. And it's sometimes, like you said, it's from people who you've grown up with black people. So you've surely touched it once before. It's hair. I don't understand. You literally have to ask white people. I don't know.
I don't know what the fascination is.
I don't know what it is.
I don't get it.
Like, we literally never go and like, can we touch your hair? Like, it's hair. I see you've got a pretty hairstyle. I see you've had a haircut. Great.
Yeah, but that sort of, I'm going to touch another human being without actually asking.
I've had that loads of times.
I've only seen it another time, something different, and that's with pregnant women. People wanting to touch the bump.
Yeah.
But I kind of, even though, don't do it, like, but ask, but I get it because there's a moving baby in there and it's not something that everyone gets to experience. But it's just like, go to a black hair shop, find a wig maybe, that's like an afro, and then
bring it home with you.
Do you know what I mean? How about it? You just don't need to just keep doing that. And also, do not ask black women if it's theirs. Just don't do it. You're like, why do you need to know if it's theirs or not?
Meanwhile, they're wearing clips and extensions and stuff like that. Like, It's a hairstyle, relax.
Yeah, and it looks nice. Just say, your hair looks really nice. Like, if you want to inquisitive, you could say like, how did you get it like that? Like, what was the steps you took? Do that, and then that's up to that person if they then want to explain to you after how that happened. But you don't have the right to ask. I don't ask you, how did you afford those trousers? What's your salary that able to? I don't do that. So don't be asking people, is their hair theirs? It's none of your business.
And what about the question? But where are you from originally? Because you both must have experienced.
But you know
that.
What? That's an interesting question because I get asked that by black people sometimes, and it's because they just want to know where your heritage is from. So I guess again, it's the intent as to why you're asking that question.
Yeah.
So if I get asked by a black person, they're not asking because like we're obviously not from here. They're just like, so where is your family from? Yeah. What's your family background history? So I know like, you know, someone might be Congolese and someone else might be Nigerian. So I'm like, oh, are we of the same or are we kind of not? And what's that culture like? Whereas when someone that's not from my race asks that question, then it's like, and if I say to them, oh, I'm British. Oh,
My first answer should be good enough.
Right. But then it's like, oh, no. But you know what I really mean. And it's just like, why should I know what you really mean? Because this is where I'm really from.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
If you want to ask about heritage, that's a different separate story, question. Yeah. Okay. So just know the difference between what you're asking and also, why are you asking? What does it matter in terms of what we're about to do or what the conversation we're about to have? Why do you need to know that? So, and again, if you act like that, like, well, why do you need to know? Oh, I'm just asking. Gosh, you don't need to, it's not that deep. And it's just like, I'll let you know if it's that deep or not. You don't need to monitor that for me.
So. I literally just had it the other day because I work in schools a lot and I was working with a group of boys and I think I was doing a condensed 6-hour session with them and one of the young white boys, we came back after break, so by this time they'd gotten kind of used to me and my co-presenter who is a white male. They got used to us, which is cool. We want them to be as comfortable as possible. It's like, sir, where are you from? I said, oh, UK, London. About to go back into classes. Like, no, but I mean, so I said, oh, you mean where am I from? He's like, yeah. I said, for my mother's vagina in a hospital in Dulwich, which is in London, which is in the UK. I said, why was my first answer not good enough for you? He's like, no, it was. And I was like, but it wasn't because your first response was no, I mean. So why wasn't what I said good enough? I said, where would you like me to have been from that would have made it okay for you, my first response? He was like, I was like, if you ask them the question, absolutely fine. I don't have an issue with someone asking where you're from. If you're asking about heritage, different story. because I might sometimes I'll say I'm from Britain, I'm born here, my parents are Jamaican, so I might have that conversation as well. It depends on my mood and the moment that we're having. Like, it's not a big issue for me. But when someone gives you, you've asked a question and they've given you an answer, it's when now you decide, never met me before, you now decide you know more about my DNA history than I do.
Yeah, or I'm going to probe more. Yeah. That's not good enough, that answer. I want to know
if
more.
If I said a Caribbean island or an African place, then it would make sense to you because we can only have come from those places. So yeah, that happens a lot. But the teacher did say to me, also, it's like, I really liked the way you responded back to his question, because he said that particular student, there's issues around that person. And I said, it's learned behavior for him to do that. So it is sometimes about just challenging that moment with them and making him understand there's ways to go about that and have this conversation. You ask a question, an answer was given to you, take the answer from there, or learn to navigate in a better way. But he was fine. He was fine with that. We all laughed about it because I said the word vagina. But I was like, well, yeah, I'm from London in the UK. That's where I'm from. So yeah, but that does happen quite a bit.
And you mentioned your parents' heritage there from Jamaica. What's their experience been like coming to the UK? What was it like for them when they arrived here?
So again, when we were talking about this, I was like, actually, we haven't really spoken much about it. Because my mum came over when she was 9, is when she came to this country. Because my grandparents were living here already in Dulwich. So they had their house set up and then they sent for their children. And my mum is one of the eldest, so she came over. But we haven't massively spoken about in terms of race and the differences. I mean, obviously you'd get the history in terms of where they all used to go out and stuff like that. And it's just always just been a given that there was a separation between blacks and whites. Even on the road that I grew up on, there's a family a few doors down, Irish family. So this was back in the time, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs and stuff like that. But they all used to play on the road together. But I do remember my mum telling me one of the boys calling them the N-word at the time. But me being there growing up now, they're still the closest friends with each other as they've grown up, because they just came through that time together. Everyone's grown up, they've all changed as people. They know it's not okay to be saying those things. But we've never really gone in depth with it, which I wonder why.
And sorry, and you just saying that now, that's another question. Don't ask a black person why as a white person you can't say the N-word. Don't ask.
Well, I think it's important. Yes. I'm not gonna kind of go down that road with it, but we were talking about it the other day, weren't we? That, you know, a colleague of mine who was doing some work with a company, and the whole board of directors asked why they can't say the N-word. And she was flabbergasted by this, just saying, well, why would you want to say it?
That's literally always my response. Why do you want to say, you know what it is, you know what the connotation is, even if you don't fully understand it, you know enough of how offensive it is that we don't even say the word, you say the N-word. So why do you want to say what do you need from the word?
What are you hoping to achieve by using that?
Other than, you know, but you as a person that's not black, feeling that there's nothing that you can't do.
Basically,
no one can say no to me on anything.
Actually, I think it does come down to that. It's about that white idea of, I must be able to do everything, or I must be involved in everything. It's like, you can be involved. You can be involved. You don't have to say that word. You don't have to say that word,
though. Don't say anything. So that came to me.
So you're both actors.
Yes.
When you were growing up wanting to be an actor, were there any sort of black actors that you thought, that's the person that's motivated me to want to get into this industry? Who inspired you?
To be honest, there wasn't a black person that inspired me when I knew I wanted to be an actor, which was 8 years old. It was Julia Roberts. That was what my thing was. But I was like, what black girl from Catford is going to be a Julia Roberts? That's not going to happen. And we were talking about, as we got older, we watched things like The Real McCoy.
Yes.
The comedy, Desmond's. There was those types of things. And then again, it wasn't until my late teens that Angela Bassett had just done What's Love Got to Do with It. Uh-huh. And I was like, whoa. If I want to act like that. Yeah. So it was always an American influence. There wasn't really, other than The Real McCoy, really even then there black. Wasn't any, that was a comedy, so there wasn't any like drama acting that I was just like, I really wanted to do. So yeah, it was white actors. And then it was Angela Bassett for me was like, and then after that was Viola Davis, that I was just like, oh no, we're doing this. And also they were like dark skinned black women. So it wasn't your Nia Longs and your, what do you call it? Halle Berry's, again, that don't look like me. Again, that representation of having a dark skinned black woman, that was work for me. So that was like, oh, I can do this. And then you started to get your, I've forgotten her name, her surname is Baptiste, but she did
Mary
Trace.
Jane Baptiste.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I started to see British black actresses like that, and then started to see, oh, okay, cool. So we can do it. Because again, I didn't know she was British until she was being interviewed. Yeah. And I was like, oh, wow, you're doing the whole accent thing. And then obviously Idris Elba started doing it, and you got your damn Idris doing it, and now we're all doing it. But that's only come later on when I was already kind of starting to get into it. But yeah, I just knew for me intrinsically that's what I wanted to do. But yeah, I didn't really have those kind of influences. All American.
For me, in the beginning, it was just Michael Jackson. I just wanted to be Michael Jackson. Like, there was no two ways about it. I wouldn't dance, I wouldn't do anything else. Acting wasn't really a thing for me. I just wanted to dance is what my first passion driver was. It was dance. I remember going for Halloween. That's Michael Jackson. For my mum, bless her soul, I looked up, but she's gone. She's not the dilly departed. She's still here with us. Still very much here with us. She made me the outfit from the Bad video, like with all the rings and stuff that. She got her little weave that she put it on my head. I had a little curl at the front. It was so good. But I was obsessed with Michael Jackson, so I just wanted to be a dancer. And then as I grew up and got into dancing, kind of moved through the industry, my attention kind of turned into acting. I was like, oh, you're quite good at doing that as well. And then for me, it was Whoopi Goldberg and it was Will Smith that made me like...
The original Aunt Viv as well.
Yeah, okay,
original
yes.
Original Aunt Viv for me.
What's that, Janet Hubert. That day, really, I was like, I want to do that as well. But Real McCoy was a seminal moment, and similar one for British television.
And Sister Act 2. Sister Act 2, for sure. Yeah, that was,
Real McCoy was such a seminal moment in British television because it was all black cast, and it was the funniest thing. I remember watching it with family members. This was our thing to watch.
And we can watch it now and still laugh, right?
I still well, here's the thing, what the BBC did, when it was over, the BBC told everyone they lost the tapes. Footage. So we can never see Real McCoy again. It was done with... they've been doing it. They're trying to erase black voices and erase black artists that have been there. They wouldn't have been a Goodness Gracious Me without the Real McCoy because Mira Sayal and Sanjeev Bhaskar were in there. That's how they found... That's how they got their writing chops. That's where Goodness Gracious Me jumped off from. So many black artists just wouldn't be existing without something like the Real McCoy happening at the time. But BBC tried to say, they lost the tapes, we don't have it. All of a sudden, when the George Floyd moment happened and everyone and their friend were now suddenly, we're gonna do more for black faces and black voices. Suddenly, 20 odd years later, oh, we found the tapes, so we can put it back on BBC iPlayer. And they did it on BBC iPlayer, but then taken off again, but it's back on, it comes on randomly now, so I just started recording it and keeping it on my Sky because it's just so good. But again, there wasn't a huge amount of black artists on TV growing up, black British artists on TV.
And if there were, they were in things like Rising Damp, or they were in shows where they were just the token.
Didn't so they identify.
They were one dimensional. They popped in, they popped out. They said something funny, they left.
You had Lenny Henry, but then comedy. Wasn't thinking about being a comedian or anything like that, so I didn't associate him with anything else. But it was mostly an American influence when it came to actually acting and being like, oh, that's a thing to do.
Has it got better?
In some respects.
Yeah, it's got better. We're not on a level playing field, I just want to make that very clear. But it's better than what it was, and we're very grateful for those that have opened the door for us.
Yeah, 100%. It's great.
And I feel like there's a renaissance at the moment of black creatives. Mm-hmm. And also South Asian creatives as well, and East Asian creatives as well, where we're all starting to really champion each other and really push forward with stuff. And again, the conversation we were having is like, it's all well and good you having people in front of the camera, but if they're not people, if black and South Asian and East Asian people aren't writing their own stories and aren't directing their own stories. Like I did a play recently where there was a conversation about black people, and we had a white director, a white writer, and a white lead, and they were having conversations, and we had to keep being like, yeah, again with that high pitched tone, okay, but have you considered da da da? And they were just like, oh, that's the point. Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll think about it. And it was just like, it's not really for you to think about, actually. It's for us to tell you that that's how it is. So please listen and consider and actually do, rather than just think, oh yeah, I'll just think about that and then just not. So it's important having people behind the camera as well, leading those forces, because otherwise, again, you're just going to get one dimensional characters.
Yeah, and nothing. Which still does very much happen. Even a job that I did where this particular character, he was a real person and I was portraying his life for a job. Part of the script, he was an enslaved person. Part of the script was his mother and the enslaved owner had sex in order to create him. The director was like, there was a particular line that I had to say, and he's like, well, can you make it really cheeky? Like, I say something like, my mum never told me much about my dad. And he was like, can you make it really cheeky? Like, well, my mum never told me much about my dad. I was like, well, no, he would have been a product of rape.
Yeah, he raped my mum.
Like, it wasn't an illicit affair, this toy affair between this black woman and this hunky white guy. He would have been a product of rape. He did listen. He was very open in the moment, which is great. But it is those moments of having just those voices in space and not just having them there just to show face and just for a tick box exercise. They're in space to listen to these other voices, because if that's not your lived experience and that's not what you know, then listen to the people who it is who are giving you advice on what it might be for them. Even down to Coronation Street is a perfect example. Right now, there's a family on there, a black family on there, who there are some moments on there, I'm like, who is writing for these people? It's not a black family that most of us recognise. I'm not saying they don't exist, of course they do, but it's like, who, it's like, that probably wouldn't happen in most black households in that way. But it is, sometimes you might have a black person or a brown person in space to write, but they're still fighting against the white head figures saying, actually, you might alienate these white people who do that. But it's like, we're sitting there watching all dimensions of a white person. You're not alienating us. So why do you feel the white audiences who don't get alienated by just listening and watching what it might be for somebody on the other side? So, yeah.
And we can't go through this podcast without mentioning Dreaming Whilst Black. Because
of course not.
You're obviously...
Yeah, if you didn't.
Your brilliant show that you've just been in, and we've just seen the first season of that on the BBC. Why are shows like that so important?
Because, again, Ajani Salmon, who created the idea and the show of it, or the steerhead of that, he made sure that, again, not only are we going to be talking about the... aside to the Black British experience that's not glamorized in some sort of gang culture type of way, but he also was very clear, I want all heads of production to be black, because he understand, even with my character Amy, the fashion, the hair, the script writing, the fact that he had Yemi, who was a British Nigerian woman who also wrote on a few of the episodes, but also champion and voice for the black women, because the journey being a black man, there's only so much he can do. He can, sure, you can see his mothers and aunties and friends and cousins and all that sorts of stuff as black women, but you don't know. So again, him just saying, having all the moving components and making sure everybody is heard. And that goes down to costume of what people are wearing, that goes down to hair. Women, black women's hair, it's a very important part of our identity, and it's very powerful. And it was beautiful that we got to show that. It was beautiful that my character was able to represent what Afro hair can look like. It's not just wigs and weaves or just a big Afro. Actually, we can do styles with it. We can play about with it. We can play about with color. We can also play about with like the jewelry and make that like more colorful and things like that. And so it's important, because that is a show that literally I get DMs from people about at least 5 times a week, someone saying, A, that was really triggering. It really hit home. That was me the other day. That was me last week. But also, you made me laugh.
Yeah.
Because if we don't laugh, we're going to cry.
Yeah.
And actually, I actually, for the first time, feel seen and heard. Like, a lot of people, not in a horrible way, but a lot of people are just like, I can't believe this is a BBC show. Because it's just, it taps into things that throughout TV history hasn't tapped into before. And it's the everyday...
it's the nuances and the moments that happen. That
type of experience. Because obviously, yes, we have the gun culture, that is a type of experience. But it's not
every black person's experience.
Yeah, there's so much more to being a black person in Britain.
Not everyone was doing Top Boy or being on the estate like that. I didn't grow up on an estate in that way. Not that I say I don't have friends or I don't recognise that.
Yeah, we'll recognize
but it just wasn't my lived experience in terms of that. But that is very much what gets produced or gets money thrown into it. Anna Johnny did that brilliantly by the end of, don't spoilers, in terms of for anyone who hasn't seen it yet.
Why haven't you seen it?
In terms of the decision that needs to get made, what they want to fund. It's just like when you look at Hollywood, the films that get the most traction and the most plaudits are always the ones when you're looking at black pain and trauma. It's always the ones where a black person is enslaved to somebody or somebody's helped. I didn't watch 12 Years a Slave, and I literally, from that moment, I just refused to watch any more enslaved films. I was like, I'm not doing anymore. Not that the stories shouldn't be told and still continue to share, but why are these the only stories that we see? I'm so tired of it. So from that moment, I just haven't watched any of those enslaved films, didn't watch 12 Years a Slave. I got the book, and I was like, do I want to read it? But I think I'm going to read it, but I don't want to watch them anymore because it's always black trauma. It's trauma porn, as someone, I can't remember where I got it from. I was like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's trauma porn, and we always have to see black people in that position for it to get any type of award. And like, well done you for pretending to be enslaved.
I think the thing I loved about Dreaming Whilst Black is that as a white person, I can hear and understand what you've just talked about in terms of very often how black people are represented in film and TV. You know, at the start of the podcast, you talked about your agent telling you to get your hair cut because you'd only ever be considered to be a criminal.
Yeah.
And I think when I've been delivering some training recently, there was a black guy who was on the course who said, look, when I was growing up, there were no black heroes, superheroes. There was no positive roles that black people did in drama or TV. They were always the criminal.
Yeah.
And, you know, the word black was always to describe something negative rather than something positive. And the thing that I loved about watching Dreaming Whilst Black, not only the fact that you were in it, and, you know, there was the bit of me thinking, I really hope this is good. And it was. It was so funny. It was so warm. It was heartbreaking. It was powerful. It was cringy to see some of the things that people said and what your lived experience was like. But I felt really proud to see it on the TV and to see regular life and regular, you know, people interacting.
Absolutely. And that's one of the key things. It's like, we were talking about, again, the idea of just black excellence, that we always have to be magic or this amazing entity. And it's like, when we see white people on TV or film, you get the full gamut of a human being as it's supposed to be, the good, the bad, and the ugly, which is what we all love to see. We can also look at the same thing for women, where women have always only been seen this one particular way on TV or films, when actually we like to see women who are completely flawed, because that's the reality of life. With black people, there's a gamut there's an array of different people that exist within the diaspora of being black. Why don't we get to see all those things where they don't necessarily have to be excellent? Is this someone working in a call center or someone, but this is everyday life for them. This person is going through the mill. Let's look at that. Let's look at what their conflict might be. It's been fantastic. There's been other shows with The Wolf is out right now. We've got a black lead, a black male detective, which is fantastic, a great show. I just watched The Pacts the other day, which was a black family based in Wales. And I remember the lead actress, and I can't remember her name right now, forgive me. She was on BBC News being interviewed about a show, and they were talking about the level of racism that she's received from, again, white people and Welsh people, saying, oh, this isn't true, this doesn't ring true. And she's like, What you're saying, there's no black people in Wales.
She's from Wales.
Literally.
She's got a Welsh accent.
Literally got a Welsh accent. She's from Wales. And the idea of seeing a black family, it literally makes some people's heads spin. Like the adverts that happen where they're like, oh, this doesn't ring true. There was an advert with a black girl and there was an alien. Oh, this doesn't ring true. There's an alien right there. Relax. But they had a problem with the black person being there. Little Mermaid. She can't be black. It's a mermaid. Relax, sir. And it's always grown men. Like, relax.
it's not always. Majority.
The thing that I find interesting about that, let's just briefly talk about The Little Mermaid, because you're right, people were up in arms that a black actor had been cast to play the role of Ariel. Well, that person didn't play it in the cartoon. No, because it was animated.
Yeah.
it was drawn. But the fact is, that was the best person for the role.
Yeah.
And it's also the power. I saw, videos of young black girls seeing that and thinking, that could be me.
Yeah.
I've got something to aspire to. And absolutely. I know that, my nephew just said to me, how come there's a black actor playing that role? And I said, because she was the best person to play that role.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, okay. There was no kind of pushback about, well, that doesn't make sense. It tends to
it's adults.
Other generations that
kids
think
is like
that
an explanation,
person,
as they should get. They ask a question, give an explanation, they'll move on with their life. It's adults who put so much hate onto this child or just into the world. Oh, it's going to ruin my childhood. If this is going to ruin your childhood, I'm going to guess there's a lot more going on in your childhood, sir or ma'am. There was such an uproar. It's like, it's a mermaid. The black maiden was a problem, but a talking crab, that's fine.
That's fine, yeah.
Let's get a grip here.
What are your hopes for the future in terms of inclusion and equality?
The more, like Danny said earlier, and a lot of us knew this was going to happen at the time when the George Floyd moment happened and you had everybody and their friend, every corporation and a friend rushing to say, oh, we're going to do more, we're going to put so much more. A lot of us who were black, we looked at each other like, side eye, because we know what's coming. You'll say these now because you don't want to look a particular way, but within a couple of months' time, you'll go back to exactly what was before. Mm-hmm. There has been an influx of more black actors being on TV. Great. But as I said before, they're still not behind the cameras. They're still not in positions of power. This idea of whenever you talk about these things, sometimes you'll get the pushback from some white people, quite a lot of white people actually. Well, it should be the best person for the job. Yeah, no, absolutely. If he was actually paying attention, we've all been saying that. It should be the best person for the job. However, a whole array of people are not even being invited to the room to be part of the process for that job. Or sometimes when they are in the room, they're totally dismissed because we know we just need to tick a box like that.
I remember at university, our lecturer told us that a corporation, who I won't name, needed to up their figures for more underrepresented communities. And so they just employed them in the cleaner roles. And it was a TV production company. Hmm. Yeah, because they were like, well, technically we still fill that quota.
Uh-huh.
They didn't put them in roles. They're actually doing anything creative. They just employed more cleaners of other races to do those roles. So the levels that we'll go to, even now, like the inclusion and diversity chief executives, there's been like, I don't know, like 7 that quit in the last 2 months.
Uh-huh.
It's like these initiatives are now finished and they're like, well, we've done that now. We don't need you anymore. So
literally,
you can go, sort of thing. And what I was saying to Leon earlier before is just like, I hope that this just isn't, I hope we're not having a moment.
Yeah.
Because there's Champion and there's Riches and there's Dreamin' Whilst Black.
Yes.
And there's going to be Three Little Birds coming out and then Nancy Boys and there's Queenie. And there's all these predominantly black shows that are out and spearheading and doing really well. And I really just hope that this isn't like, do you remember that time in 2023 mm-hmm. when all those programs came out after that George Floyd thing? And then it just, but then you remember when it went back?
Yeah.
And it was like, because before then, we had to wait every 5 years for something to come out.
Only a few black people would be allowed to do it. It's like one black person in, one black person out. And if one black person messes up
we're all done.
If this show that has a predominantly black cast messes up, then we can never have black people as the leads again because it messes up with this one, whereas everybody else gets to fail because that's part of life, that's part of the process. And then it's also, what do you always quantify as failing? If you haven't been doing the marketing for said program, then how do you expect most people to find out that this program, which is for people looking like you, that it's even there. It's happening right now with Marseille Martin, who is from Blackish, the young girl who's one of the youngest Hollywood producer, because she did that film, I can't remember what the name of the film is, but she's got a show on Disney which she produced, which is about young black kids who, some of them are skaters, which we don't always see. But Disney haven't really been pushing that, so a lot of people hasn't. So thank God for social media, where, which is why certain persons is trying to close it down or bought it to destroy it, because social media made it easier, much more accessible for everybody to connect and say, here's this thing, here's what's happening. It represents us, but everyone's invited to the watch party to watch us. So thank God for things like social media, because even when they do make those productions, they're still not given any marketing budget that they would to other productions to be out there and push it. So numbers are up there. So I'm literally elated to have seen Dreamers Whilst Black go from the episode to full season, then to go from BBC to mainstream on BBC One and I think it was on BBC Two?
Three.
It was on BBC Three, but then it would show like later on BBC One.
Yeah, but yeah.
But then we go in a Showtime in America next month. So we're going.
Incredible.
Yeah, we're going international.
You don't want it to be a flash in the pan moment. Like, we want it to be, take note.
Yeah.
Take note. People want to see this. Not just black people. Everybody wants to see the different things, the different thoughts to how people are reacting within the world. It's like the Barbie movie. They're like, oh, this made so much money. We should make more stories about toys. No, the focus was women. We want to see more women
like
films
Parasite
like that. Like,
and
come
Squid
on.
Game coming from Korea. Just
yes.
Like, how many talented Korean filmmakers are out there, and TV makers and writers, and we get an insight into that world.
Yeah.
Because over here in the Western world, we don't see a lot of that, you know, East Asian, what's happening over there. So it's, and what that says about, and what Parasite and what Squid Game say about society, like, it's, these things are prominent.
Yeah.
But it's
we
like,
want to see,
we'll
we
check
want to
it
share.
Out and then we'll close it, because we can't have too much, because then that's, whoa. I hope in my lifetime I see equity. I really hope in my lifetime I see it for my children. I really hope I do, for my nieces and nephews. I'm not going to put...
No.
I'm not going to hold my breath on it. But I know that we're going to do what we can.
As per usual, you have the ones who are fighting back hard to not do equity and inclusion, because giving some other people equity would mean you potentially have to give up something. Mm-hmm. And that's truly what equity looks like. You're not losing anything. You're just saying, here's some for you too.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
trying to get certain demographics of people to understand that is very hard. Like, we see it now in America and here, where they're trying to take away more gay rights. They're also trying to peddle it back to what was with the Enoch Powell, in terms of, the reason why you have nothing, poor white person, is because these people who are coming over on boats, who've never met before, they've never been in this country before, but they're the reason why you have nothing, not the fact that we keep robbing you blind. And it is that age-old thing. So there will always be some people fighting back really hard, but this new generation that's coming up, they are kicking ass and making changes in a way that I never thought I would see in my lifetime. So I hope it continues, and our job, our role now in the time and space that we are, is to push as much as we can in whatever arenas we're in to try and make it somewhat easier to help you in the fight you have ahead of you, because it is a fight, it is a constant fight. And sometimes I really despair for the first time in this country, like, I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't. I'm really worried for my niece, who's 6. I'm really worried for her and what happens to her generation and her age group, because there's a lot of people trying to go backwards.
So my final question for both of you then is, what can white people do to be better allies to underrepresented communities?
Hashtag... Don't be racist. That would really help.
Yeah.
Also, don't make it about you.
Uh-huh.
Please don't make it about you. If you ask us that question and then we give you an answer and you're like, yeah, but don't you feel that? No. Listen to what we're saying. Don't just hear us, and don't have a conversation with us just to have your voice heard. Uh-huh. If you have no intention of actually listening to what we're saying and trying to really understand and implement that, do your research. Stop just asking us. find out things. I don't mind when people ask me questions sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm not an encyclopedia and I'm one black woman with my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for my best friend. I can't speak for my auntie. Can't speak for other black people out there. So stop doing that. Just because you have one black friend does not mean that you're fine. You're not. Do the work. There's more things you can do there. And just have an open mind. And like, please talk to people that you know are not cool. I don't know why my skin color or my hair offends people. I don't know why it is. It does. I don't get it. I don't know. So why don't you, as an ally, find out why that is and then have those conversations. And when we're not there, be that voice when we're not there. Don't just lend it to us. Because sometimes we're in spaces and people say things and we feel really uncomfortable. And we know if we say something, it's going to be a whole to-do.
I'm not the problem.
That, yeah, and if you can see that, then speak up for us as well, because that would also help. We can see when people are uncomfortable in a room, or we know when something's not right. You coming up to me afterwards and being like, oh, that was really, you know, I was really sorry that you said that. That doesn't help me now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I
get that it's scary at first, but it's like anything. Practice makes permanent. Start doing it. You'll start to get used to it, because we can't always do it. It's taxing. When I walk outside my door, I'm on, and I said this to Leon, like, as a black woman, I am an activist, whether I want to be or not.
Yeah,
I'm a walking activist. Everything I do, I'm standing up for something. So I get tired, and black women, we get tired, and actually we're not strong, we're not superhuman. I mean, we have to be, and we do it, but doesn't mean that we don't need respite, and we don't need help. We do. So do some of that.
Yeah, all of that co-signing, all of that. Reading is important as well. Akala has a great book, Natives. There's a book about white fragility. That is a trigger word for so many white people, in terms of that. When you say, when we're dealing with race, it means that you have to navigate white fragility a lot of the times. And I've had a lot of white people get really, really offended. I'm like, the fact that you're being offended right now is literally the point of white fragility. If we're talking about race and now you're centering it on you, that's
crying doesn't help. I'm not saying that you're not upset, but when you cry, I then have to be there for you, and we're talking about me, but now as a black woman, I have to be there for you as a white woman. Please don't do
that. If I've said that thing is racist or offensive, it doesn't mean that you are a racist person. There's a distinction to be made here. Let's tackle the problematic language that may have been happening here. It's okay, we're learning. It's cool, let's work on that moment. Reading, I would say reading is fundamental, and learning other people's experience. But the key thing is listening and wanting to actively help make change is, for me, probably the most important.
Just because you wear a t-shirt doesn't mean you're helping the fight.
Right?
Please don't do
more. All those ones when I was at the Black Lives Matter march, I sleep with black men. Okay.
Please. But also, we all do different things. Like, I remember when the George Floyd happened, and they were like, we should all be protesting, it's not good. And I was like, do you know what? I've been doing this. I've been living this black life my entire life. So you don't need to tell me that I need to protest. If that's not my way, there's protesting, there's donating, there's you doing something for the community. There's different ways you can help. So don't feel like you have to do everything, and don't look at other people and tell them what they should and shouldn't be doing. Do what you're doing. People, if they like it enough, they should follow you. If they don't follow you, then it's not for them. But just do you. And allow others to heal and do things in their own.
If you have a problem with it, you don't like it, it's okay to sit down, shut up, and get out the way of other people who do want to push through with change. Because ultimately change, especially when it comes to race, change in that way has a huge effect in changing other things. When you deal with racism, you can get to class, because class is a much bigger issue. Racism was invented to keep us fighting there, so we don't look at class and don't go against that. We start figuring out racism, we can start getting rid of the ones on top who are making it really difficult for everybody else. So yeah.
Danny, Leon, it's been a genuine pleasure to speak to you both. Thank you for talking through your lived experiences. It's been a really interesting conversation with you both. So thank you.
Thank you.
For more of our podcasts, visit our website at podcast.tedlearning.co.uk, or you can find us on most podcast platforms.